the Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. March is Women's History Month, and quite appropriately, we fill the month with shows on women in American history. This week, we take up women in basketball as Eileen Dugan interviews Pamela Grundy and Susan Shackelford, the authors of Shattering the Glass, The Remarkable History of Women's Basketball. After that, Fiona Beattie will join us for another of her sites of the week, this one on the history of basketball in general and women's basketball in particular, and Michael Farquhar will offer us the last in his 10-part series of readings from his book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at a recent article in news you may have missed on basketball. According to an article that appeared in the Kansas City Star, the two typewritten page original copy of James Naismith's Rules for the Game of Basketball is up for sale, and it could be sold for as much as $10 million. As we will learn later in this show, Naismith invented the game, and he wrote its first rules, some 13 all told, in 1891. The rules have been in the possession of Naismith's grandson since 1995. They were first written in Springfield, Massachusetts, where the game was first played, but they then traveled the country with their author. They spent 3 years in his desk drawer in the Denver, Colorado YMCA, and 3 decades in Robinson Gym at the University of Kansas, where he served as the university's first basketball coach. The rules have always been in the Naismith family, according to Star journalist Blair Kirchhoff, but technically they are owned by the nonprofit Naismith International Basketball Foundation. And any profit from that sale will go to the foundation, which traditionally has promoted sportsmanship, but has expanded its purview to include humanitarian efforts to support shelters and orphanages for children in the Caribbean. Naismith himself was orphaned at age 9. And the sale comes with conditions. The buyer must consent to a 2-year nationwide tour of the rules and then permanent display at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. James Naismith was a 30-year-old instructor at a YMCA training school in Springfield, Massachusetts, when his boss asked him to come up with an indoor activity for his gym class. On December 21, 1891, Naismith created the 13 rules, which provided the basis on which the game was built. It may have been intended for young men, but as we know, and is the subject of this week's interview, it became a women's game as well. More on that in a minute. This is Talking History. When did women begin to play basketball, and with what reception was women's entry into the sport met? Talking History's Eileen Dugan asks these and other questions of her guests this week, Pamela Grundy and Susan Shackelford.
Given the popularity of the WNBA and the strong TV ratings for NCAA women's basketball championships over the past few years, one might assume that this success is merely the culmination of women's basketball's steady progression from obscurity. But has women's basketball's road to acceptance been as smooth as we would like to think? Joining us today are Pamela Grundy and Susan Shackelford, co-authors of Shattering the Glass, The Remarkable History of Women's Basketball. Welcome.
Hello, Eileen.
Hello.
When did women begin to play basketball, and what was their game like?
Well, women began to play basketball in 1892, just after the game was invented. It was originally invented for men, but it was picked up very quickly by women. The women of that era, however, played a very different game. They modified it to suit what was considered appropriate for women at the time. So they played a much more sedate game. The court was actually divided into three sections, and each player had to stay within one of those sections, so no one had to run too far. They could only dribble once, and all physical contact was forbidden. So women were very excited to be playing this new game, but it was definitely a different version of basketball from the one men played.
Why did the concept of women playing basketball meet such resistance in the early days?
Well, actually, it didn't meet a lot of resistance early on. The women's colleges, which were more progressive at that time in their views toward women, really took to it right away. And what happened was it became so popular that it began to raise questions about, do we really want women to be this physical? Do we really want them to be this public? They were quick to bar men from coming to watch these women's games on these college campuses. So initially there was great reception from the women themselves, but then all these, I guess you would say, public concerns began to arise. And again, it was kind of how people viewed women. Is this really appropriate? And then there began to be the resistance and the fading at these elite women's colleges.
You mentioned in your book about how African-American women also embraced the game very early on and how their play was sometimes different. How so?
Well, African-American women had the advantage that in many black communities, ideas about womanhood were broader than in other communities. Black women had always, for example, worked physically very hard. There was no question if you could pick 200 pounds of cotton in a day, you could run all the way up and down a basketball court. That wasn't really an issue. And so African-American institutions, particularly colleges, encouraged women to play competitive sports and to be more assertive on the court than white women at comparable colleges were able to do.
What about at the high school level?
Well, the game became really popular at the high school level in the 1920s. After the elite women's colleges began to cut back on their programs, the working class had really started playing the game, and it began to spread around the country, and the high schools embraced it tremendously. And it also began to go into towns where they would have commercial teams sponsored by a newspaper or sponsored by a manufacturing plant or something like that. The high school game really was kind of a spinoff, in a sense, from this push broadly into the working classes. And that really is what put some roots down for the game for the first time.
Who were some of the early stars of women's basketball, and what obstacles did they face playing the game?
Probably the first woman who became a national star was Babe Diedrichson, who's actually much more famous for track and golf activities. She was pretty much the greatest female athlete of the first part of the 20th century, but she got her start playing high school basketball, and then she moved up to play AA amateur basketball working for a company. There were a lot of factory and company teams, and she played for one of those and won a national championship and became an All-American. But she faced, both in basketball and other aspects of her sporting life, this whole series of questions, again, about whether top-level athletic activity was really appropriate for women. And in fact, there were a number of questions about whether Babe really was a woman. How could you be such a tremendous athlete and actually still be a woman? And so she faced a lot of criticism of her activities and also of these kinds of questions.
And women were also playing professionally as early as the 1930s and 1940s, weren't they?
Yes, they were. They were playing on traveling teams, what some people know as barnstorming teams, and they would go around the country and play teams in small towns generally, even some larger towns. And what was unique about this process is that those teams in the towns were usually men, And these traveling women's teams would go playing town to town, and they were so good, and they played together all the time, they generally won. They were quite impressive, and these were among the top women players of the time. But that was really the only way you could make a living doing this back in the 30s and 40s. We didn't have any kind of pro league for women.
How has the social and political climate of the United States affected public attitudes towards and support of women's basketball?
I think that's a really important question. That's really one of the things we're trying to get to in the book, is to help people understand how closely women's athletics has been shaped by the broader social climate. And I think one of the other things that's important about that is that this climate differs depending on where in the country you live and basically what social class you belong to. If you were part of the upper middle class, upper class, go playing at these white women's colleges, there was an acceptance of some degree of play, but there were very strict restrictions on what you could do. Again, you were limited in your movements. You had to appear ladylike, had to dress ladylike. When you get into the working classes, which also includes the rural areas and African Americans, there's a much broader sense of what women are able to do physically and how they should be in public. And so you get this real blossoming of the sport in these rural areas, working class areas, African American areas. But then what you see actually in the 1950s, which is the sort of unfortunate part of our story in a way, is all across the country you get a real closing down of options for women. It's the Cold War era, and it is a time where gender roles, people become very conservative about gender roles. There's a lot of anxiety in the country. And that really starts to shut down women's basketball on all sorts of levels in the U.S. Before, you couldn't play in college unless you were African American. Then it starts becoming harder to play in high school. High schools start to get rid of their teams. Factories start to get rid of their teams. And so you really see how this broader climate of opinion about gender starts to have a profound effect on women's basketball.
What about the civil rights movement and the women's movement? How did that affect women's basketball?
Well, the civil rights movement had a tremendous effect. I think a lot of the women that were involved in that movement saw what organizing was about. And in some cases, they were making the coffee and they were not on the front lines. And it helped them see that they had their own issues. And the women's movement really helped bring about the rebirth of basketball as a major sport for women. Had that movement not happened in the late 60s and early 70s, we probably wouldn't have women's basketball today on near the scale that we do. It was just that, again, like Pam was saying, that notion of womanhood began to change again. You know, we got this broader notion with the women's movement, and people realized, well, we should be able to play sports too. And then, of course, Title IX came out of that, and Title IX was the big boost to getting women's basketball and other sports into basically an opportunity for women.
Actually, about Title IX, we tend to associate it automatically with women's sports, but what was its original purpose?
Well, Title IX was really designed to open opportunities for women in education, particularly in terms of faculty positions and other positions within universities. In fact, the women who conceived of the idea and pushed it weren't even thinking about sports. In fact, nobody really associated Title IX with sports. It simply says that men and women should have equal educational opportunities. And no one, when they were putting this through, sort of sat down and said, wait a second, at colleges we're spending millions and millions of dollars on men's sports and virtually nothing on women's sports, and this is going to be where women are really being denied opportunities, because people just took that for granted. People just assumed that men had big sports teams and big crowds and women maybe had intramurals, and that that was just the way it was. And it was a great shock to many people when, in fact, it turned out that Title IX was going to apply to athletics and that colleges were going to have to make major, major changes in their athletic programs.
So was it easy for colleges and universities to make equal opportunity for women in sports?
Well, it would have been easier if the people in charge, by and large, were willing to share. And most of these people already had a belief that they weren't putting enough money in men's sports, even though they were putting the millions in there, like Pam said. The competitive nature of sports, you always want to win. So winning is linked, in many minds, and rightly so in some cases, with spending money. Back in the 70s when all this was happening, you know, most of the sports world just wanted to keep funneling money to men's sports because of a competitive desire for those sports to do well. And some, not all, but some also didn't appreciate that women deserved this opportunity. Particularly, they didn't appreciate it if it was going to be at the cost of any money toward their programs. So, you know, there was a lot of resistance. Basically, they had to have the law hanging over their head to do this. And there was a fight through most of the 70s to mitigate Title IX by the established forces, but they lost. And finally, the people in charge said, well, we're just going to have to do this. And so they did.
What brought women's basketball to wider public attention, especially in the 1990s and beyond?
Well, it had been getting more attention along as great players came along, and they got some attention. Nancy Lieberman was an early great player that received quite a lot of public attention. There was the Olympics. That was a place where women's basketball got attention. Cheryl Miller in the early 80s had a major impact when she turned up and was the greatest player anybody had ever seen. And by the 1990s, there was enough interest in women's basketball that there was a decision made at the highest levels of the U.S. Olympic Committee and other people involved in women's basketball, including the NBA, which was interested in promoting women's basketball as well, to put together an Olympic team for the 1996 Olympics that would showcase how great women's basketball had become. And they put this team together. They picked the best women's basketball players in the country and toured it for a year around the country just to showcase how good these players were. Because lots of people, and lots of people today think, oh, well, you know, women's basketball, it's just not as good as the men's. They're not fast. You know, they don't play this exciting game. But a lot of those people hadn't seen how women were really playing. In fact, today they haven't seen it either. And the criticism usually comes from people who haven't really seen the game recently. But they put this team together. They toured it around the country. It culminated in the winning of the gold medal at the Olympics in Atlanta. And then right after that, the two professional leagues, the WNBA and the ABL, mm-hmm. started. And that, again, began to bring a new version of women's basketball to the public eye.
And what role did business and media play as well in the rising popularity of the sport?
Well, it was huge. The NBA and the Olympic officials, when they put together this 96 team, made sure that they were in the media's eye the whole time. So that was a huge thing. And they had corporate sponsors. That's who funded that effort. They trained and toured that year. Then the WNBA got a TV contract. Pam mentioned there were two leagues. And the reason the WNBA survived and has excelled is the exposure. And TV was the big one. The ABL was never able to put together a good TV package once the WNBA was announced. And with the backing of the NBA, it just gave them such clout that the ABL never could rise to the occasion in terms of that media exposure through TV, even though they had the better talent in their ranks.
What challenges remain for women's basketball?
Well, I expect we both have something to say about this, but I'll start off. I think right now women's basketball is in a good position. It has a very committed group of fans. There's a segment of people in this country that just support women's basketball tremendously. You look at the crowds at the University of Tennessee, at the University of Connecticut, the excitement around the national championship. There's a whole group of people that really appreciate that women can engage in this intense sporting activity. They like to see women getting out there and be aggressive and go after the ball and move quickly and just play a game at a really high level. But I also think that in a broader sense, there are a lot of people in this country, perhaps even the majority, who don't necessarily appreciate that seeing women do that kind of activity, don't take pleasure in watching a woman dribble really hard down the court and put the ball in part because I think that a lot of people still hold ideas about womanhood, that this aggressive play, this exciting, fast competition just don't mesh with if you compare what female basketball players look like compared with female pop stars, for example. You know, there's still just so much emphasis in our culture on sexuality, on flirtatiousness, on this sort of other component of womanhood that has dogged basketball players for really for a century, and that's not what basketball is about. And I think until there's a broader appreciation of the kind of female qualities that basketball brings out, I think that will remain a challenge.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much. We have been talking with Pamela Grundy and Susan Shackelford, co-authors of Shattering the Glass, The Remarkable History of Women's Basketball.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
Welcome back. We opened this week's show with reference to an article in the news concerning the inventor of basketball, James Naismith. And we just heard a discussion of women's basketball. Well, Fiona Beattie joins us at this point to tell us where we can learn more about both.
Dr. James Naismith, the inventor of basketball, has left us quite a legacy, and the Basketball Hall of Fame honors that legacy for both the in-person and virtual visitor. Located in Springfield, Massachusetts, the birthplace of basketball, Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame offers multimedia presentations, a theater, internet and webcam kiosks, a museum store, and more. The virtual visitor can read an essay, Naismith Untold, that reveals the man behind the myth, or the original scanned script, the speech Naismith delivered in Springfield on January 5, 1932, on the origins of basketball. And for those interested in trivia, it is true that peach boxes were used. What would Naismith think of basketball today? Read an imagined but historically based humorous conversation with the two men hailed as the founding fathers of basketball, Drs. Luther Gulick and Naismith. Click on Hall of Fame and you'll find hundreds of notable individuals involved with the game in several teams, complete with photos, bios, playing statistics and histories. Perhaps of greater significance for this show is the account of the early formation of a women's basketball team made up of Springfield College stenographers and faculty. But for much more information on women's basketball, click on the site's link for the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame, located in Knoxville, Tennessee. John Molina's website at womensbasketball.com provides an excellent selection of photographs of early women's basketball teams, along with texts and further resources. To visit the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame, go to www.hoophall.com.
Finally, we conclude this week's show with the last of Michael Farquhar's readings from his book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. This week he reads a selection from part 10 of his book, titled Gotcha, and the second chapter of that section, The Weirdest Thing You Ever Sawed.
A retired carpenter known only as Lozier proved with a monumental hoax in 1824 that people can be almost unfathomably gullible. Lozier convinced folks in Manhattan that the island was in danger of snapping in half and sinking because of overbuilding on the lower end. If the situation were left unremedied, he warned, the results would be catastrophic. Incredibly, Lozier convinced the city's honchos that the island had to be sawed in half at the lower end, known as the Battery, dragged out past Ellis Island, turned around, and reattached at the heavy end. Few apparently doubted the feasibility of such an audacious undertaking. Hundreds of laborers were commissioned, some taking underwater breathing tests in preparation for steering the detached portion of Manhattan. Carpenters and blacksmiths adjourned to their shops to create the necessary tools, which included 100-foot saws and gigantic anchors to prevent the separated island from slipping out to sea. To feed the workers, Lozier ordered 500 cattle, 500 hogs, and 3,000 chickens assembled at the construction site, while barracks were hastily built to house the laborers. It was reportedly a scene of bedlam, with hundreds of animals clucking and rooting over the din of construction. After several weeks of preparation, the big day arrived when Manhattan would be dismembered and reattached, under the direction of Lozier. Hundreds came out to watch the spectacle, with musicians and a parade for entertainment. Several hours passed, however, with no sign of Lozier. A note from him was found explaining that a sudden illness had forced him to leave town. Left to ponder their foolishness, the crowd turned irate and formed a posse to hunt down the deceptive carpenter. Lozier, though, was long gone. He apparently gained nothing from the venture except a marvelous sense of accomplishment.
You've been listening to Michael Farquhar reading from his book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds, published by Penguin Books. That's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beattie is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.